Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So what did we learn from Mitt Romney's tax returns released formally this morning? It's no surprise that the highly successful former equity fund manager earned $42.5 million over 2010 and 2011. And once this year's returns are finished, the Romneys expect to pay about $6.2 million in taxes for the 2 years, just less than the $7 million they've given to church and charity. In 2010, that meant taxes slightly less than 14%. David K. Johnston is a columnist for Reuters. He's also the distinguished professor of tax law at Syracuse University. David, I know you want to focus on one aspect of these returns, but you say the biggest thing you want to underscore is that everything is legal.
Absolutely.
Break down the numbers for us. Let's take this 20 or so million in income this year. Now, Mitt Romney made maybe 14 million or so off money that he invested. So these are his capital gains, returns on stocks and interest on his savings. Then there's the money that he made off someone else's investments, people who invested in his former company, Bain Capital. He and others at Bain Capital, in effect, were paid by those investors for making their deals, but were paid with the profits of those investors. Explain how that works.
A successful manager like Romney gets a share of the profits he produces, and Congress allows the manager to be taxed the same way people who had capital at risk is, at this very low 15% rate. It's called a profits interest. Romney doesn't have an ownership interest. He doesn't have any stock, but he has a right to receive income. And that produces big benefits for him, especially in terms of passing money down to his sons.
We want to pick up on that, but we should say this idea of this profit interest, this carried interest, it's legal for managers at private equity firms like Bain. But Romney also takes this income years after leaving Bain because this is his retirement deal. It's all legal. He continues to get these profits from other people's investments, and they come to him as income, but he can file them at the lower rate. But you mentioned his sons. This is something that you've really focused on in the reading. Tell us more.
Well, the Romney sons have a trust fund with $100 million in it. Now, currently, the maximum amount a married couple can pass to their children without paying gift tax is $10 million. They've got 10 times that. But the Romneys confirmed through their lawyer to Reuters that they did not pay any gift tax. So how did they pull that off? Well, they apparently gave the sons some of their carried interest. And because the carried interest is not an ownership, it's a right to receive profits, Congress lets you value that gift at zero. Now, think about that. You value something to your children at zero because you don't own the stock, but you know it's going to pay you huge amounts of money. And in this case, they have $100 million in their trust fund. If my wife and I had $100 million and wanted to give it to our kids, we would pay $31 million in gift taxes.
So let me understand this. This is, you know, perhaps investments that were made by people who invested in Bain Capital years ago, with a promise that part of the compensation for Bain making the deal would be profits from that. These profits are spinning off to Mitt Romney years later, who is then spinning them off to his sons, and so nobody's paying taxes on them.
Exactly right, except for the last part. When you get the income, you have to pay it at the 15% rate for most of it.
Yeah.
But it means that the parents have effectively pushed forward not just the $100 million the sons have, but they avoided the $31 million of gift tax. So they've really, in effect, given their sons the equivalent of $130 million without paying any tax. And nobody can do that except people who run private equity funds like Bain Capital Management.
Yeah, banks can't even do it. We have a primer on this at hereandnow.org. But David K. Johnston, what do you think happens now? As you have been very clear in saying, this isn't as much about Mitt Romney as it is about the tax system. And as we can see, this money that's generated that's sort of treated, even though it's income, even though it's a gift, it's not taxed at the same level it would be for average citizens. Do you think that's going to change?
Well, I hope so. At the heart of this is a split going on in the Republican Party between Main Street, that's the Newt Gingrich sort of folks, and Wall Street, that's the Romney kind of folks. And to get real tax reform in this country, we have to stop treating certain classes of people as special and privileged and different than the rest of us.
David K. Johnston of Reuters and Syracuse University on how Mitt Romney's tax returns are shining a light on the tax structure. David, thanks so much as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Have you heard of travelers? In late December 2010, 8 young people died in a warehouse fire in New Orleans, a tragedy, and one that exposed a lifestyle unknown to a lot of Americans but well-known to our next guests. It's the life of the traveler. These are young kids who leave their homes, sometimes crawling out a window with just a packed garbage bag over their shoulder. They hop freight trains, squat in abandoned buildings, skateboard on rooftops, create community through Twitter and Facebook and fellow travelers, and many of them leave behind families that really love them. That warehouse in New Orleans was one of their squats or homes. Journalist Danielle Morton takes us inside this world in a fascinating article in the Boston Review. She joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Danielle, welcome. And by way of bringing in our next guest, you've got a very personal connection to this world.
I didn't know much about this world either until my daughter, Marissa, decided to join them. She dropped out of college and hit the road.
And Marissa is also with us on the line from San Diego. Marissa, you there?
Yeah.
Marissa, let's start with you. Why? Why take up this life? Why scare your mom? You know, because you know you did. What pulled you towards it?
I was pulled towards some sort of adventure. I guess I had just connected to it in high school. I had some friends who had said that they had rode trains and had a great time. And but I was more drawn to the music aspect of it. A lot of my friends play music on the street, like busking, and I was really into that. I was really into Woody Guthrie at the time, too. So I guess before I went to college, I had hooked up with a couple of people and hitchhiked around and played music on the street. I had kind of a failed train riding attempt. And when I went back to college, I had even had friends who would call me, and I'd board them up in my dorm room because they were traveling, too.
I have to ask you, Marissa, you say failed train riding attempt. Why? What happened?
Oh, I just tried to get on and got chased.
Oh, at least it wasn't, you know, getting your hands run over, which, you know, your mom writes about one of the travelers who had some of his fingers severed. But we certainly have known this life existed. We actually booked a traveler once on the air, but he didn't show up, you know, because it's kind of an ephemeral thing. You're not usually in one place for a long time. But I guess, Mom, you know, Marissa's explained what the pull was, but some listeners might be saying, well, wait a second, isn't the better question, why did you let her go?
There is nothing
How can you?
I was already gone.
What can you do? I mean, you know, my daughter called me and said she was thinking of dropping out of school, but she already had done so. I mean, she was committed to this already. And what could you do? Stand, if you could find the van that she was going to get in and drive out of town, what would you do? Stand in front of it? You know, I mean, even though we had some pretty heated phone conversations during the 2 days where I thought she hadn't yet dropped out of school, at the end of the day, it is her decision. It is her life.
In fact, you write about another mom you met whose daughter would hop out the window and go off to whatever her adventures were. And so the mom thought she would force a confrontation by locking the window. And instead, her daughter just left.
Yeah.
I don't feel like people should be contained like an animal. I mean, if I'm of age, I should be able to make my own decisions. I felt a little bit dulled artistically at that school, and I felt really inspired by a countrywide music tour that I was about to embark on, and I've had a lot of guilt for what my parents were going through because they were worried, but I kind of acted on impulse out of arrogance.
Well, but you make it clear, Marissa, we can hear, you weren't running from them. You were running towards something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a career decision.
But from a parent's point of view, you do think, and I did think, that she was rejecting me, even though actually she told me several times that I had nothing to do with this decision, which for a parent also is a form of rejection.
Well, in fact, you write one of the great lines, Danielle, the radical freedom of my daughter imprisoned me. You know, what a great way of describing these invisible ties between loved ones. You know, what is for someone a wonderfully reckless, exciting journey is for the one sitting at home, as you said, imprisonment, fear, worry.
You know, my daughter is a very intelligent, talented individual, but the thing that I was worried most was not that about her wits or her skills, but about just the danger of this world. Mm-hmm. I'm a journalist, so when she stepped off into that world, I started looking into it just to see what kind of life she would be leading. And then I had to stop because I just thought, I can't look any further, which is why this story was a coming together for my daughter and me, because we went to New Orleans together to look into how these eight people got into this squat on that night and what forces drew them onto the rails. And the other question I wanted to know was I an outlier among those eight sets of parents of those kids, or were there others like me? Because previous to my daughter leaving, I thought when I saw these people on the streets that they must be, you know, young bums who are old bums to be, and I had a contempt for them. But then once my daughter joined them, I had to look at them in a different way. So I did, and the story really helped me do that.
Let's talk about that. Marissa, did you know some of the young travelers, as they're called, who died in the warehouse fire?
I knew one of the girls as a friend of a friend, but I never met her.
But you knew of this kind of a life. You knew of this kind of a building. They exist in other cities as well. You both went to the burned out building together. Marissa, what did you think when you saw it?
It's extremely tragic. It was a big blow to the community. I could see how sad and how deeply affected the community of New Orleans was by it.
And Mom, Danielle?
There was a memorial board, a plank that was put in the ground, and it said, "For the kids," and around it were the heaped little Veladora candles and the charred dog backpacks. And Marissa and her friend Izzy and I were standing there. We kind of held each other for a while, and it was just kind of a moment of silence for the eight people who died. I had many times imagined that Marissa would end up in a squat fire because, as the New Orleans Fire Department said, there's so many things in a space like that that you don't know anything about. The floorboards of this warehouse had been soaked, were old railroad ties that had been soaked in creosote, which is flammable, and there's kind of no way to know that if you're just passing through.
Well, and the kids had a fire, sort of like one of those outdoor fires, but they'd brought it indoors, and so
they had carved a piece out and put the fire barrel in it and then clad the edges of it with metal that they'd scavenged from some of the abandoned buildings in the area. But so not to know that kind of basic issue of fire safety there, which is that the metal cladding heats the floorboards, makes them highly flammable, so that if there's a spark, of course you're not supposed to have a fire indoors anyway, but if there's a spark, then the whole place would burn down. And so mm-hmm. I had that feeling of connection to the sorrow of the kids, and also I felt about the parents who probably had the same yearnings that I had and feeling of a tragic separation of their children, many of them, and they didn't know how dangerous this life could be. And this was standing in the ashes of it, you know, standing in the worst possible outcome. That was really very hard to handle.
That's Danielle Morton. Her article about that New Orleans warehouse fire that killed eight young people, known as travelers, is in the Boston Review. We'll link you at herenow.org. Her daughter Marissa lived the life, but it was also a joyous one, riding atop Grainers in Alabama, squatting in a well-known-to-travelers seven-story abandoned apartment building in Philly. She says it was awesome. All the travelers got an apartment. But when we come back, more of the downside here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with journalist Danielle Morton and her daughter Marissa Spohr. Together, they traveled to New Orleans to find out more about a warehouse fire that killed eight young people who were travelers. These are kids who leave home, hop freight trains, live in abandoned buildings, just like Marissa once did. Newcomers are called oogles. They're shown the most stable squats, places to live, the most plentiful dumpsters. Kids sort of adopt each other as siblings. And New Orleans is a mecca for them because there are more than 40,000 abandoned residential properties there. And homelessness, for many of these kids, is a choice. Marissa is a musician who dropped out of college to become a traveler, busking on the streets of New Orleans, and then ultimately taking her mom, Danielle, to the scene of the fire and into the life. And Danielle, before the break, you were telling us about visiting, you know, this awful scene where this fire was, and thinking about the parents who died there. You ultimately talked to many of these parents, and many wanted you to know these were good, happy, well-loved kids, just free spirits that couldn't be contained. But there were also problems.
I would say that if you were to do a sort of, like, I'm a sociologist view of this, you would say that many of the kids come from a very high-conflict divorce family. Many of them have substance abuse and mental health issues in their previous generations. Several of them had learning disabilities, and while they were quite smart and very sensitive, the school setting never worked for them. They couldn't sit still long enough. Their minds were too free-ranging. And so this combination of factors and with an exquisite artistic sensibility meant that they had a pull towards something that was grander and bigger than was available through the sort of steady progress on a career path with education and that kind of thing. They had a need for something dramatic and authentic, I think, is the word that they would use. Wouldn't you, Marissa?
Yeah, I would say that's about right.
Yeah, many seemed, in the reading, Marissa, many seemed like you. They just had the need to jump out the window, you know, to jump out an open window to see what was on the other side.
Yeah, I would definitely relate to that. I mean, as soon as that band showed up and said that they were playing my songs and that I could go on tour, I got all my stuff in a garbage bag and left it in my friend's attic and got in a van and went to New Orleans.
But I'm wondering, Marissa, I know people busked, they panhandled, they learned how to ride these very high bicycles that we've seen around where, you know, you weld the seat high up and that became a sort of a part of it too. Like a performance art kind of thing. But were there moments when you just hated it? Like, I'm cold. I'm tired. This warehouse is dirty. That, you know, were there times when it
for
just...
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, of course. If I was in a really awful situation, I'd usually have the mindset that tomorrow was another day and it was going to be beautiful tomorrow. But today I'm getting rained on and I'm in the middle of nowhere and I don't know where, you know, I don't know when the next train's coming, but... Definitely, I think the most depressing for me was when I realized that I didn't want to busk anymore, and that's kind of when I set my sights on going home.
The other thing I want to mention is that the train hopping stories are epics. Almost everyone I talked to had a story that had an incredible high moment, you know, like snaking along the side of a mountain where there were waterfalls on one side and rainbows on the other. But that story had started with this awful moment when they almost were dehydrated, dying of dehydration. But when people would tell me these stories, they would always end with the idea that, you know, yeah, it was terrible, but you were doing it with your friends and you had to rely on each other for survival and that you knew each other more in a more realistic way in a few days traveling together than you would years and years of casual contact in school or at work. So there was this electricity about the intensity of the experience that was part of the draw.
But Marissa, I guess I'm wondering, do you understand the anger? There was a lot of tears shed over the 8 who were killed in New Orleans, but there was also anger expressed. I'm thinking of the cop who talked to your mom, and these are cops that, you know, had to retrieve the charred bodies from the warehouse. And he said, here's my question. Is it really so bad where you come from that this is better than that? Is it really that bad? And can you understand the anger of people who may not care what you do, you know, in your life? Go ahead and do it, but don't break my heart by getting killed in a warehouse.
I can understand that anger. I mean, we were all pretty brokenhearted over it. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, 8 lives.
That's why
eight
there's lives. Not much to say. I mean, when you ask that question, it is very specific to, you know, one person. Like, I could say that, of course, I love my mom and my dad. My home life was great. You know, nothing too bad went on that I wouldn't come back home to. But I couldn't say that that's the same for everybody, and everyone has a different story, and you can't just discriminate an entire group of people by saying that they're all rich kids or they're all from middle-class families or all of their lives are great. Yeah. There was turmoil in my family, too, so,
yes.
I mean, it's unfair. It's unfair to judge people, a group of people as a whole instead of individually. I mean, I'm sure that anybody would say that.
Yeah. I think a lot of people, when you see kids on the street panhandling and they're dressed in this way, you know, they just snarl. And I know I did at one point, too, and think of them as, you know, these rich kids who could be doing differently with their lives and why don't they take a bath and how come they don't go to school. But that's actually not recognizing exactly what Marissa is saying, which is that there are many roads that lead to the attraction to this kind of life.
And the other thing is, when I was being snarled at, I was snarling back. So.
Well, I just want to thank you both. Daniel Morton's story about a terrible fire in New Orleans that killed 8 young travelers, as they're called, appears in the Boston Review. There's a link at herenow.org. We've also been speaking to her daughter, Marissa Spohr, who has been a traveler. Danielle, Marissa, thank you both so much.
Okay,
thank you.
I've been sitting on your windowsill in the daytime.
By the way, Marissa talked about her music. This is one of her songs. It's called Windowsill. And we want to hear from you. Do you know this life? Maybe have a child in it? Or maybe does it make you angry that kids are taking this risk? Well, college kids take risks, too. We'd love to hear from you. HereAndNow.org. News is next. Here and Now.
It's getting colder and I feel a chill in the nighttime.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and by Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu. And by the Institute of Contemporary Art Boston, with Isaac Julian's 10,000 Waves, a 9-screen video installation featuring Maggie Chung, icaboston.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama is expected to address economic fairness in his State of the Union address tonight, a topic Republicans have been fighting over on the campaign trail. Mitt Romney, who founded the private equity firm Bain Capital, has been called a vulture capitalist. We all remember that. Accused of buying up companies only to break them up and lay off people to make profits. But in addition to being an equity manager, Romney is also a venture capitalist, investing in companies. And the two, investing in and buying out, have been lumped together. We want to hear from voters about the State of the Union. So let's start with a venture capitalist, Bijan Sabet. He's a managing partner of Spark Capital here in the Boston area. And Bijan, do you want to hear the president make a distinction between some of the rougher parts of private equity, as they've been called, and what you do, investing in startups like Twitter and Tumblr?
Yeah, I think we have to celebrate. You know, we're in this tough economic situation that we all know, and there's a few things that are going really well in the United States from an economic point of view, and that's the technology world, specifically the startup world. I'd love to see the president really shine a light and celebrate that the U.S. has created, you know, all this opportunity and all these jobs because of what's going on in technology. And we should talk about that and embrace it and discuss how we can make it even better.
Well, and what would you like to hear in that realm? How can the president say something tonight that the government can do to support high tech?
I think there are a few things. There's been a lot of discussion about network neutrality, and there's a lot of big businesses that are trying to put an end to network neutrality. And the basic concept of network neutrality is that, you know, the internet should be open and available so that any startup can create new web applications and not have to have any obstacles in their way as long as it's legal. And that's the notion of network neutrality, that an ISP, an internet service provider like Comcast or Verizon, can't pick and choose winners.
Well, and you want the president to get that specific, because then he'd be picking and choosing a winner right there, you know.
I think the president shouldn't pick winners and losers, but I think that we should just continue to embrace the notion of network and neutrality. That's what's been happening to date, and we shouldn't change that.
You're an investor. You know the debate in the economy is whether to invest further in the country, you know, with stimulus or cut. Some analysts like Paul Krugman are noting, if you look at Europe, where they've tried austerity, the U.S. economy has actually done better. But what would you like to hear the president say as an investor to jumpstart jobs, to jumpstart the economy? What will you be listening for?
The thing I specialize in and I'm passionate about, I used to be an entrepreneur. Now I'm an investor in early-stage technology companies. I'd love to hear President Obama talk about how we can continue to accelerate the growth in technology. That's something that's really working, and a lot of things should come out of that. So, for example, our education system should be reconfigured so that we teach computer science in middle school and high school. We really don't do that in the United States today. And that's part of the whole ecosystem, if you will, of ensuring that we've got a competitive, vibrant technology industry in the United States. Is we have to start, you know, with students and education, and that will contribute to our continued leadership in this area. So I think the president should look at it as like a big picture and talk about, in order to kind of sustain our leadership in technology, these are all the things that we have to do.
And education key for you?
It's key. Education's part of it. Policies that keep the internet open. It's all of these things. It kind of feels like specifics and narrow points of view, but it all rolls up into this notion of, you know, we've got a few bright spots in our economy, and technology is one of the brightest, and how do we keep that going?
Bijan Sabat of Spark Capital here in the Boston area. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you.
Okay, so what do you want to hear from the president tonight? We're going to hear from more of you in a minute, but here's some response in the meantime. On our Facebook page, Stephen Mattingly wants to hear about lowering the debt. He says it's the most important thing for this country. Penelope McKibben says she wants the president to declare his full support for same-sex marriage. Connie Rinaldo Reddy says she wants to know how he plans on fixing what's wrong with this country. She's worried about money in politics, which she says ultimately causes these do-nothing Congress situations. But Lucas Friedlander had something else in mind. He says, I want to hear more Al Green.
So in love with you.
The president breaking into song at that fundraiser at the Apollo Theater in New York last week as Al Green stood off to the side. Don't think we're going to hear that tonight, but again, let us know what you want to hear at hereandnow.org or on facebook.com/hereandnowradio. Back in 30 seconds, Here and Now. Welcome back. What do voters want to hear from the president in the State of the Union tonight? We're taking a random sampling. 28-year-old Ben Brown of Brooklyn, New York, is the founder of MakeMeSustainable.com. It's a social media company that helps organizations calculate and reduce their carbon footprints, a company recently acquired by Noveda Technologies. So, Ben, what's on your mind?
I think the issues I'd like to hear talked about more is how to spur innovation in clean technologies through a better regulatory environment. An example would be some sort of price on carbon.
So you're saying carbon emitters should have some sort of fee or tax or penalty?
I just think that they have to have some sort of price signal.
Well, but you also want to, as you said, have renewable energy initiatives. Let's talk about Solyndra. President Obama's plans to boost alternative energy took this a major hit because of the solar energy company Solyndra. It went bankrupt. It cost the government $535 million in loan guarantees. There were accusations that the administration turned a blind eye to problems at the company because of politics. This has obviously slowed down any future investment in alternative energy. Your thoughts on that?
That was a complete debacle. That type of support, government support, does not help clean technologies. I think direct loan guarantees aren't the type of framework. You're picking specific winners and losers. And Solyndra is a really, really specific example that is a bad example, as opposed to companies like Bloom Energy and other innovative companies that are working on battery and fuel cell technologies that I think can be winners. But if you provide a framework and a market where in which, again, these things like the price of carbon, things like supports for renewable energy credits, the subsidies for renewable generation, then you're not picking specific winners and losers, and you're providing a framework for various types of technologies to win.
What else would you like to hear from the president?
The biggest issues we face right now are how do we become competitive in the 21st century? President Obama has talked about that a lot, and to me, education is one of the most important things out there. We are building towards an environment where in which I think the next credit bubble is student loans. I would like to see programs around student loan forgiveness, restructuring of credit, things that help preempt what could otherwise be a pretty bad credit crisis, both for the economy in a macro sense, but also for individual decision-making on students after they're out of school. Being a small business owner in what I would call a social for-profit, I'm trying to attract the same talent that would otherwise go to engineering firms, technology engineering firms, or even potentially Wall Street. You're trying to hire people that have to deal with $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 in student debt. They don't really have the flexibility to make decisions that appeal to their higher sense of good and what they want in their life.
They can't afford to work for you.
Yeah, well, and they can't afford to work for themselves. I think that's the hardest part.
Ben, thanks so much.
Well, thank you so much, Robin. I appreciate your time.
Okay, let's bring in 60-year-old Audrey Peterman of Fort Lauderdale, Florida, originally from Jamaica. She's been an American citizen for 15 years. You might remember we spoke about her campaign to get minorities to go to national parks, as she does. So, Audrey, what do you want to hear from President Obama tonight?
Well, I am hoping that the president will bring forth a message of our common destiny as a nation, because I really think that that has gotten lost in the fray, and everybody's so fractious. And I think that we're missing the point that this is America. As Congressman John Lewis, who was a cohort of Martin Luther King's, frequently says, it doesn't matter how you got here. We are all in the same boat now, and we share a common fate.
Let me ask you about another area. You're there in Florida, one of the hardest hit states when that real estate bubble burst. A huge, I think it's upwards of 20% unemployment in some pockets in Florida. What would you like to hear in that regard?
First of all, I would like him to give an explanation of what happened, because people are still walking around shell-shocked, not knowing what happened, and also being very concerned about the fact that nobody has paid a price. But then I would like him to bring in the issue of climate change and what we're going to do to bring in new green energy solutions so that people can get back to work and people can work in progressive and sustainable industries and hopefully build a life again, which includes home ownership.
President Obama was the president who rode into office, you know, promising change and igniting hope in people. How should he address, what were his campaign mottos?
You know, I want him to rise to his true potential and stop being beaten down by, I have to say, Republican naysayers. We have to get back to moving our country forward. I think that's the single most important thing that he has to do, to stand his ground and call upon the people now to harness that hope that seems to have been squandered.
Audrey Peterman there in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Audrey, thanks so much.
Bless you, Robin. Thank you.
And now let's bring in Trey Lamb of Paul's Valley, Oklahoma. We first spoke to him in July of last year about that record drought that cost farmers and ranchers crops and cattle. And Trey, we understand you were lucky in that you only lost a few head of cattle, but the drought's still going on. So what do you want to hear from the president tonight?
As a farmer who just lived through the worst drought since the Dust Bowl, ideally I'd like to hear him say something about a commitment to the farm programs and a safety net to keep farmers in business in these times, especially the government continued support for crop insurance.
Crop insurance. Now, this is an insurance on your income or anything like that. This will what, give you the cost of seeds and fertilizer?
Right. Because it's so expensive to plant and grow crops, insurance companies make available insurance. In case you have a catastrophic failure like this, they will pay you back basically the cost of establishing the crops. It's not for profit, it's just to keep people in business.
Keep you going. And this insurance, although it's privately handled, it's subsidized by the government. So you're looking for the president to assure you that that subsidy is going to be there?
That's right.
Well, and there's been talk of cutting crop insurance funds as this farm bill goes through Congress. But what else would you like to hear from the president?
On the natural resource environmental side, we had this terrible drought, and so that makes us think about soil and water conservation and maintaining programs that provide technical assistance to farmers and ranchers on how to keep the ground covered, how to preserve water, how to protect water quality. So I'd like to see that. Just as a citizen and a voter, I would like to see some concrete proposals from the president on how he sees to break this gridlock between Congress and the executive branch.
He is the president, and so he's got to step up to the plate. But do you think it's only his problem, the gridlock?
Oh, no, not at all. I think there's plenty of blame to go around. I don't think there's anyone on either side that's blameless, you know, whether it's the Democrats in Congress, Republicans in Congress, or the president or the Tea Party. They're all, I don't know, angry or confrontational. That's not the way that the people expect them to govern. That's not what they were elected to do.
Trey Lamb, he's a farmer rancher there in Paul's Valley, Oklahoma. Trey, thanks, and we'll be keeping a good thought for you and for some rain.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that.
And, of course, we'll keep an eye on that speech for you tonight and bring you highlights tomorrow. Also tomorrow, The View from Egypt, a woman who used a comic book about Martin Luther King to inspire the revolution there. She gives us her view of what's happening now in Egypt. And we'll have the music of Kevin Gordon for you tomorrow. But don't forget, you can always go to hearnow.org and let us know what you'd like to hear tonight. Before we go today, the nominees are, well, do you have a minute? Because it's a very long Best Picture list that was released this morning, and we'll have that for you in 1 minute here and now. Martin Scorsese's Hugo was the big winner as the Oscar nominations were announced this morning in Los Angeles. That film picked up 11 nods, including Best Picture and Best Director. Asa Butterfield stars as Hugo, the orphan who lives within the walls of a train station in 1930s Paris. His late father was a tinkerer, repairing intricate devices like watches. Now Hugo keeps the station's huge clocks running, and as we hear in this scene, the timekeepers provide a refuge for him.
Right after my father died, I'd come up here a lot. I'd imagine the whole world was one big machine.
A scene from the Best Picture nominee Hugo, also on the very long list, Are You Ready?, The Artist, The Descendants, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, The Help, Midnight in Paris, Moneyball, The Tree of Life, and War Horse. Joining us to talk, Oscars Boston Globe film critic Wesley Morris. And Wesley, I can't help but note one thing about this list. On your list, you have none of these movies. None of these movies. Yeah. I mean, it just seems like the movies were sort of all over the place this year.
There were a lot of options, depending on what your taste is, obviously, depending on what you felt passionately about. And, you know, what's funny is that the Academy decided to change the Best Picture nominating rules so that passion was taken much more into consideration.
Yeah, this year a film had to get at least 5% of the overall number one votes in order to make the nominee list. And that means that at least 5% of the 5,000 or so voters this year thought that The Help was right. the best movie right. of the year. That was their number one choice.
Right. It's interesting. I mean, who knows if they had done it the other way, whether Bridesmaids would have been one of the 10 movies. You just can't imagine. No matter how great the pool is, you can't imagine the requisite people saying, Bridesmaids is the best
one,
movie,
right?
No matter how many Judd Apatow phone calls get made.
But it might have been the fifth.
It might have been
on
fifth 5,000 on 5,000
right,
ballots, exactly.
Right. But it didn't get
But it
on.
Didn't get first in enough right. ballots to be moved on to the next round.
I should say, in defense of your top movies of 2011, most of yours were foreign films that you picked, and that would be another category. You picked,
right.
though, Contagion.
Contagion. I like Contagion a lot. A Separation, which is actually one of the foreign film nominees this year, foreign language film nominees. Not on my list, but it came very close to being on
right.
my list. It's a great movie.
Well, let's talk about the ones that were nominated, and let's start with Hugo leading the nominations. I mean, does that surprise you that Hugo's on the list?
No. I mean, I think people who like that movie really, really, they more than like it. They love it. I'm a little indifferent to it. I think it's beautiful, but it feels very much like Martin Scorsese using this story to impart a bit of film history,
right.
to make a case for film preservation, to hold up Georges Méliès, to remind us what a great filmmaker, what a pioneer he was. Those are all worthy things. I just don't necessarily think that this is going to be the Martin Scorsese movie that I'm right. remembering in 10 years.
Well, right behind Hugo is The Artist. This is the silent film directed by Michel Hazanavicius, starring Jean Dujardin as a silent film star whose career fades with the advent of sound. It's a black and white silent film. Now, we're going to play a clip.
Right.
You're going to have to take our word for it that it's a breakfast scene. Let's listen. So Wesley Morris again of the Boston Globe. I'm with a lot of people here. I want to see this. I mean to see this. I haven't seen it yet. I mean, this film has 10 nominations, major awards, including a Golden Globe and a Producers Guild Award. But I think it's only taken in about $12 million. Most people haven't seen it.
Yeah, they're rolling it. You know, Harvey Weinstein is rolling it out slowly. But, you know, at the same time, people are kind of resistant on a number of levels. I think that the public hasn't gotten a chance to declare the movie good. It's being told that the movie is good,
yeah.
which sort of makes you a little bit defensive. And then once you go and see it, a lot of people have just been like, really?
Yeah. But your colleague Ty Burr told us early on, this is a wonderful movie. So
it's a good movie. I don't love it as much as Ty does. I don't love it as much as a lot of people do. It's slight. It's cute. At 50 minutes, I might have loved it. At its current length, I'm kind of like, ugh.
Okay.
You know.
Okay. Well, there it is with its best film nod. Also getting the nomination, as we mentioned, The Help. Controversial movie for some people. We're going to be hearing in the coming days as we get closer to the awards how some African Americans, for instance, refused to see it because it just seemed like a caricature. You, we shall tell our radio listeners, are African American. Your thoughts on The Help?
You know, I'm of two minds on it. I think it's a fine movie. It's perfectly crowd-pleasing, middle-brow entertainment. On the one hand, and on the other hand, you know, it sort of forces you to ask yourself why in 2012 or 2011 when the movie was released, why we need a movie, another movie in which the best two parts a black woman is going to have all year involve her playing, you know, someone's maid.
Maid. So there's that. So a lot, still a lot of talk generated by The Help, the story of maids told through the eyes of a young white woman in Mississippi in the 60s.
Yes.
Midnight in Paris, Woody Allen's film. Both The Help and Midnight in Paris, two of the biggest grossing and well-reviewed movies of the year. You know, we've heard people in our office saying, how come the last Harry Potter film, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, doesn't make it, especially since that would be a film that would draw a lot of people to watch the Oscars.
It's a tough thing. I mean, there's the taste of the Academy and what they like to present themselves as liking and loving. And then there's what the public has seen and can connect to. And often those things are at odds with each other.
I'm going to make sure we've addressed The Descendants. This is a starring George.
We have to address The Descendants.
Well, we do, because, you know, George Clooney, who's also been nominated for acting Oscar,
yes,
he plays Matt King, a wealthy Hawaiian landowner who finds out that his dying comatose wife has been having an affair. Now, you know, if you just saw the ads for this movie, which just showed George Clooney kind of oddly running somewhere, you would think it was just a silly...
But another Coen Brothers
but movie. But apparently, you know, Oscar-worthy, at least according to the people who vote. Let's listen to a clip. Matt has to become the primary caretaker for his two daughters, and as we hear in this scene, it doesn't start off very well.
Get out of my underwear, you freak!
No, okay, no.
Don't
back inside, put on a swimsuit.
Why?
Now!
Real good job you're doing.
That's part of why I brought you here. You have to help me with her. I don't know what to do with her.
Maybe if you spent more time with her, she wouldn't act like such a complete spaz.
So there you have just a snippet of The Descendants, which doesn't, you know, again, it doesn't sound like, well, the other nominees, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, a very sober film about 9/11, The Tree of Life about something.
Everything, yeah.
And then to round it out, War Horse, you know, again, a very profound film, World War One, Moneyball, more of a, what would you say, romp?
I'd say it's more of a study in how to manage people. I mean, it's neither a drama nor a comedy, although it has elements of both. I mean, it really is an essay about how to work with people in a particular way. I mean, it's I like that movie a lot. But what's interesting about this collection of movies is that a lot of them, I would say at least six, are focused on or set in the past. In some cases, the, you know, millennia away from where we currently are, in the case of The Tree of Life. And it's interesting that this collection of movies is saying something about how we don't want to be here, or we're not comfortable being here. We don't like 2011 or 2012.
And it would seem that it was pretty clear last year that the best picture was either going to be The King's Speech or The Social Network.
Right, right.
Do you get that sense this year?
You know, 2 weeks ago, you could have imagined any one of these movies winning Best Picture. I mean, it comes down, at least at the moment. I mean, this just happened a few minutes ago. There's still time for a movie not to release its tax forms or something. You know, there's time for something. You know, a movie to have had an ex-wife who, you know, says an open marriage was won. And I don't know. But until the artist, you know, ex-wife comes out and talks to ABC News, it's between the artist and Hugo, basically.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, the only thing that I can see doing some making a movie is probably The Descendants, the Rick Santorum of the operation. We'll see, though.
It is confusing lately, isn't it?
It is.
Globe film critic Wesley Morris on today's Oscar nominations. Wesley, thanks so much.
Sure. Thanks for having me.